Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Students are heading to Ohio State University soon, as state and federal changes could reshape their experience in new and different ways. There have been recent state and federal efforts to overhaul higher education. DEI initiatives pulled back. Research dollars reduced. Ongoing efforts to neutralize so-called liberal bias. Will there be fewer international students worried about ICE crackdowns? To talk about the new school year and his thoughts on the future of higher education, with us today we have Ohio State University President Ted Carter. Welcome back to All Sides, President Carter.
Good to be with you, and good morning, Amy.
So before we jump into the state and federal changes, can you give us a snapshot of this upcoming school year, the incoming freshman class? The last 2 years, the classes got really big. You had some enrollment milestones. Is overall enrollment up again?
So, you know, as you point out, last year we had the largest freshman undergraduate class in our history, 9,530 strong, from all over the world, all over the country. Still over 70% of them were Ohioans. And that was a little bit of an offset for what I will say slightly underperforming coming out of COVID. And that's what allowed us to take in that over 9,000 student body class. Our target is typically around 8,250 to 8,300, and that's what you should see from us in the years going forward. This year, we had a record number of applications, 88,000. 88,000.
Whoa.
And that was before the college football national championship game. So it had nothing to do with that.
Okay.
So that's a really good signal that people want to come to Ohio State. This incoming freshman class should be right around 8,200.
Okay.
We feel confident in that. We've got all the housing down payments. I mean, we're going to house 15,000 students come here in another weekend. We're going to move them all in about 3 days. So we're excited. You pointed out the international students. You know, we're keeping an eye, close eye on that. We think we'll be down slightly, but not what we're seeing on the national average. You know, they're talking about 150,000 fewer international students across the nation. That's out of roughly around 1 million a year. We're about 6,200-ish for international students on our campus. It's about 9%. I think we're going to see in our incoming class a reduction of about maybe 7% below our norm. So not on the national average, but that's our prediction. We really won't know until the first day of classes.
Yeah, you don't actually compute all the numbers until after classes actually start, so you
Correct.
See who shows up. So,
right.
But with the international students, do you know if there's any sophomores, juniors, seniors who didn't return, who left?
We feel good about that right now. Again, we won't know. Sometimes we don't even know who actually left the country until, you know, they're telling us they're coming back. Obviously, we're doing everything we can to help where there's visas involved, try to make sure that if they still want to remain students at Ohio State, that we find ways to do that. So, yes, we're navigating that like every other university in the country. And, you know, of course, you know, it's a challenge. But we feel solid that we're going to have all of our students that want to be back on our campus be here.
Do you have any protections, or are you going to talk to the international students just to make them feel safe, like they belong here, that they don't have to worry?
Absolutely. We do that. We have, you know, they have access to legal services through our student life and through our legal department. So, yeah, we try to support them in every way that we can. We really care about them. You know, as you know, I was in the Navy for 38 years. I've visited 100 countries myself. I know the power of having international engagement. Not all of our students have the privilege of going to study abroad, which is a program I'm really in favor of. So for those students that don't get that chance to study abroad, to have international students on our campus brings a different perspective. And of course, for us, a chance to show our international students our way of life here. And our international students are incredibly happy to be on our campus. I mean, I've engaged with a number of them. So I know the value of having international students, and we really care about them.
Let's move on to tuition for a minute. Ohio State's official website states that the university is committed to excellence and affordability. However, tuition increases with each class, with an approximate 397 increase for this year's freshman class. So that affordability piece, Ohio State's committed to excellence and affordability. Is it affordable if it increases every year?
Yeah, so I guess let's spend a little bit of time here putting this in perspective. You know, the cost of living, the cost of goods and services, food, you know, these things tend to go up. And we're increasing that part to that's part of the tuition at a very small rate. So when we say tuition's going up 3%, that locks in for the entire time that they're a student here at Ohio State. So if you're there for 4 years, you're really only seeing a 0.75% year-to-year tuition rate increase. It's very, very small. I mean, we're talking.
So what you get your freshman year is what you pay
for each whole time.
I didn't realize
that.
Yeah,
okay. So it never goes up again. Mm-hmm. And that's a misunderstood. I'm really glad we're talking about it. But let's put this other piece in context. So last year, we provided $525 million in aid and scholarship to over 55,000 students. So 80% of all of our students on our campus are getting some amount of scholarship or aid. It's a remarkable number. We're talking more than $500 million. What does that equate to? What does that really mean? If you look at the students that graduated this past May, 12,400, then over 1,700 that just graduated a couple weeks ago in August, 57% of the undergraduates left with zero debt.
Hmm.
And those that left with any debt was less than $24,000. You can't even buy a used car for that. So when we say we are affordable, we are really, you know, putting our money where our mouth is, and we're doing everything we can. And we're going to be coming up with some announcements on some new scholarship programs here in the upcoming weeks that are going to even speak more to affordability and accessibility. We are 20% better than the national average in terms of those numbers I just gave you, in terms of the number of students that leave with zero debt and those that leave with some debt. But we're not going to rest on that. I want us to do better. And that's part of our strategy going forward is how can we make Ohio State the best, most affordable, best value school that we can be out there. I mean, this is one of the things Americans have been talking about since 2015, when 60% of Americans said, hey, we have great confidence in higher education. Well, that has deteriorated, quite frankly. And in 2023, we hit a low point where 2 out of 3 Americans said they didn't have confidence in higher ed, principally because of the cost. Mm. You know, now it's obviously a higher cost to come to us from out of state. That's normal. But we're not competing with, you know, the Ivies where, you know, the average cost of attendance is close to $100,000. We are an incredible value, and particularly for the vast majority of our students who are Ohioans. Today, still 72% of all of our students are Ohioans.
Now, we're talking about, you know, the scholarships. You mentioned all the scholarships, but then there's also the idea of the loans. And in President Trump's Big Beautiful Bill, it puts some limits on certain federal student loans. And in particular, the American Medical Association is concerned about these limits because they're afraid it's going to prevent students from pursuing a medical degree, since medical school's tuition is one of the highest. So there are new limits on borrowing for some professions, and med school is one of them. Do you have any worries about limits being placed on student loans?
Well, we're paying attention to it, and we're doing everything we can to make sure that our students that come to Ohio State are able to, you know, afford that incredibly valuable piece of education. I can't speak to any of those impacts yet. I think, again, we're doing everything we can, but you're right. If you're going through the dental school, the vet med school, optometry, medical school, you know, those are high costs. And they're the ones that do leave with some debt. But those are also the people that leave and go to the very best high-paying jobs that generally pay those loans off the fastest.
Hmm. Now, I've done a show about vets that maybe veterinarians don't maybe quite make as much money,
yeah.
Not as a dentist or an optometrist. Okay. Well, this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about changes to higher education with Ohio State University President Ted Carter. I wanted to get into some of those changes. Ohio State is working to comply with the controversial higher education law. It's formally known as the Advance Ohio Higher Education Act, but it's more commonly known as Senate Bill 1. This was a massive overhaul of higher education system, and Ohio State has a website that they put together to keep the public informed on what's happening with how you're complying with Senate Bill 1. There's a timeline in there. So I looked at the timeline, and for this fall, it says that you will have a new evaluation process in place for faculty. What does that look like?
You know, it really isn't that much different than what we were doing before. It's a more of a formatting. Of course, you know, the faculty get evaluated already. So we're complying with the law. We're making sure that we put the right software tools in there because that's what's kind of required to meet the intent of the law. So I just want to compliment my entire staff across the entire enterprise at Ohio State. This was a big lift. You know, since the governor signed Senate Bill 1, we had a timeline to get everything done and implemented. And not only did we get to all that, it's the communication that's happening internally. Now, a lot of that happened over the summer, and we understand that a lot of our faculty were gone, and they're now coming back. So we're making sure that everybody's getting educated on what this means and what it means to have this go into implementation. So there's been a tremendous amount of communication. You mentioned the website. That was intentional because we are a public institution. We're transparent about what we're doing and how we're doing it.
Now, speaking of that transparency, the timeline says that by fall of next year, you'll have all syllabi online and easy to access. Tell me about that. There's been some pushback, I guess, about this, like, access to syllabi. Does that surprise you?
No. I think, again, as a public institution, a lot of what we have is out there available to the public. This is just another level of detail. And I've heard from our faculty that they're a bit concerned. And it just, you know, it's another level of exposure for them to say, hey, here's who I am and here's my syllabi. So, you know, again, as we worked through the details of Senate Bill 1, there were a lot of things that we did as a university push back on that we didn't think was necessary. That's an example of one, but this is the law. So, you know, we're going to work through that detail. And, you know, I have great empathy for our faculty who are really world class, doing a great job, and we'll find the way to meet that. We've got a year to put all that together. And so we've got some work to do there.
Do you think some professors will change their syllabi a little bit, less detail? I mean, even they wouldn't want, what if another university professor comes along and steals their content?
Yeah, I think that's going to be up to how our faculty do that. And again, we'll meet the intent of the law, how detailed those syllabi are and how they're outlined. Again, that's some work to be done. And again, it's a lot of work. And that's an added to, you know, everything that our great professors do to prepare courses, prepare our students, help them, give them extra hours, grade papers, grade, you know, homework, grade tests. So this is another thing for our faculty to have to do.
Another thing that's required by fall of next year is a required American government course, American government or history, I guess it says. So what will that look like to add a new course that everyone has to take?
So it won't surprise anybody. We have a lot of that courseware already. Mm-hmm. So now it's just making sure which college has that. And of course, you don't just put one course out there that everybody takes that one course. We're going to have it in multiple places because of the size of our university. So we're going through that detail right now and making sure those courses are going to be available.
So would it be some in person, maybe online, like different ways?
It should be both, right?
Yeah. What do you think of the idea? Did you like the idea of a required American government history course, or is that just something you think should stick with the history majors?
Again, you know, as we went through the details of what was in that, that was not one of the things that we said that we thought was necessary. A vast majority of our students take courseware like that already. Again, this was the intent of the law. And, you know, anytime that we have government getting very involved in what we're teaching at the university, you know, we like to think that we can control and we do a great job at what we do and preparing students to be great citizens. This will not have that big of a huge impact for the curricula that the students are already getting. So, again, we're gonna follow the intent of the law.
Kent State sent out an estimate saying that complying with this law will cost them $2 million. Do you know what's going to cost Ohio State?
So we haven't added up all of that. I can say that for sure it'll be more than that because we are considerably bigger than Kent State. And as we worked with the General Assembly, we made sure they understood that, you know, there's some administration here that we've got to go through, and there'll be costs. There's some software development pieces that are in that. And we've already absorbed all that, so we're ready to handle that. But I would say that we're somewhere in at least three times that price tag, somewhere in that ballpark.
To comply with the law, there were changes that needed to be made when it came to diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. The university closed its Office of Diversity and Inclusion, and it closed the Center for Belonging and Change. So what this coming school year, what will it look like if students want to get together, they want to feel like they belong, but their Center for Belonging is gone?
Yeah. So there's been a lot talked about what's gone away. As you mentioned, the Office of Diversity Inclusion, Center for Belonging and Social Change, they were sunsetted. And we haven't talked enough about what we've done to make sure that we're still taking care of our students. So the strategy here is where some of those organizations were focused on certain affinity groups. It doesn't mean that the work of or taking care of students goes away. In fact, our approach now is our strategy is to make sure that we're taking care of all students. We've replaced the Center for Belonging and Social Change with a new place called Buckeye Commons. And the students and our faculty and staff helped develop Buckeye Commons in the aftermath of this change. And it's now something that will support students with things like resumes, helping with interns. Internships, helping just them be successful in the classroom, giving them resources for where to go to get help. So I'm really proud of what they came up with that. At the end of the day, we're going to take care of all of our students to make sure they're successful, all students. And we're going to make sure that when we are out to hire faculty, retain faculty, that we're going to do that and approach for all of our faculty. And all of this, again, is based on meritocracy. So that's what's different. And it doesn't mean that we still won't be welcoming students from all backgrounds, as we always have, all the way back to the first classes of September 17, 1873. We're well known for that. So when we say our values are not going to change, that's what we mean by that. We're still going to be a campus that welcomes everybody, that's going to take care of everybody. We're still going to be a Buckeye family.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about changes in higher education with Ohio State University President Ted Carter. Coming up, we're going to talk about some federal changes and challenges to higher education. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Days into his second term, President Trump put colleges and universities on notice that it would no longer be business as usual. He quickly began reversing Biden-era policies and withholding federal funding, or threatening to withhold the funds, to bring compliance. The Department of Government Efficiency, known as DOGE, made further cuts to higher education. And for Ohio State, it translated into millions of dollars, mostly in research and funding grants. In early August, Trump ordered his education department to collect information on college applicants across the U.S. to know their race, gender, test scores, and grade point averages. Still with us is Ohio State University President Ted Carter. Thanks again for being here, President Carter.
Amy, good to be with you.
So you appeared on the CBS show Face the Nation recently to talk about changes with higher education, and your appearance drew some criticism from the Ohio State chapter of the American Association of University Professors. So they wrote a long letter on their website, and in part it reads, "The compliant posture of the current administration, bending to the whims of those who see university faculty and students as, quote, the enemy, has seriously compromised and threatened academic freedom and freedom of speech at Ohio State. Now, it's hard to read a letter on the radio, but I would like your response to that criticism.
Well, the good news is we live in the United States, and the freedom of speech is alive and well, and they can critique me. Now, when I went on Face the Nation, I spoke to academic freedom as the very bedrock of academia and how important that is to us. I think it's kind of hard to critique that. Mm-hmm. I wore the uniform of our nation for 38 years. I've supported the Constitution of the United States. I know a fair bit about the First Amendment, freedom of speech. I've protected that. I bring that apolitical nature to the job that I have here. So again, you know, I find it kind of interesting. The AAUP, which is an institution I have been behind for most all of my academic leadership career. But this is an organization that chose to support an academic boycott a year ago, which even the American Association of Universities, the top institution of which we are proud members, 71 universities between Canada and the United States, they came in and did not support the AAUP and what they did there. So, you know, you can't have it both ways if you're going to criticize academic freedom. We stand behind what we are going to do in academic freedom, and I feel confident that our faculty will feel comfortable as we go forward in that space.
In your role as university president, in terms of this, they said that you didn't push back enough for state and federal changes. Do you feel like once it's a done deal, the only course is to follow the new rules?
Well, sometimes you have to look at what's happening in the landscape and play the long game. I would make the argument that we have been very successful in handling this changing landscape in higher education. I mean, you pointed that out at the beginning of this discussion. I think most academic institutions have been very slow to say the criticism of the American public of higher education is something maybe we should be paying attention to. You know, as I mentioned earlier, 2 out of 3 Americans just a year ago said that higher education costs too much. They weren't sure what the return on investment was. And they said, we're not even sure what these, you know, literally hundreds of billions of dollars in research are doing for me or my family. I'm one of those leaders that said we ought to be paying attention to that. And maybe higher education needs to pivot and change. So we've been leading in that change. And we've also been dealing with the changes that are coming out of the federal government and the state. So, yes, we've had to play some defense here to make sure that we protect our research grants. We have not seen hundreds or billions of dollars in impact to our research. We're a $1.6 billion in grants last year. $775 million of that came from the federal government. We've seen tens of millions of research grants impacted, some of which we are working in lawsuits to claw back. But the point is, even though we've had researchers lose some grants, of the 14,000 researchers that we have on our campus, we haven't laid off one, not one. That's not the case at many other campuses. So we have not had to go through some of these really major, major impacts to financials. And part of that is a credit to our research department, who has an incredibly diversified portfolio. But, you know, just on the research side, and I know I'm anchoring on this a little bit, we ought to be able to talk about the impact that our research is having for Ohioans and for the nation. They're doing some the most amazing work that are changing how we get the most amount of crop from, you know, flooding or from those times when we're in very dry climates, making our land more resilient. Some of the work that's happening in Alzheimer's and diabetes, some of the work that's happening in medical procedures to better serve our soldiers and our sailors and our police force. So I would make the argument that Ohio State is doing the right things for the right reasons, and we've seen much less impact than some of these other universities that you're hearing get in the headlines.
Before we dive a little deeper into the research grants, I wanted to just circle back to, you called yourself apolitical. You said in your position, it's an apolitical position. But do you feel that practicing compliance with some things coming out of the Trump administration, isn't that political in and of itself?
No, it doesn't have to be. In fact, what I try to do is focus on the mission. So the mission at Ohio State is to provide world-class teaching and learning, to do research that changes and saves lives, and provide the best clinical care that we can through our world-class medical center. So when we focus on those things, and when federal or state laws change, you know, we'll get in that argument, we'll get in that discussion when we're invited, and we certainly try to insert ourselves into it. But when they pass a law, we really have no other recourse but to follow the law. That's not bending the knee. That's just following what the government that's been voted in by the American public said, this is what you're going to do. And that's our charge as a public institution.
Well, I guess the professors who wrote your letter would say, no, you don't have to follow in. You can push back. But then you're going to end up losing money and you'll become like the Harvards.
Again, I do this for the betterment of the entire university. You know, one of my first jobs is, first of all, make sure we do no harm. But that means also protect and defend the mission of The Ohio State University. And then we're going to do the best job we can to make sure that we stay vibrant. I mean, yesterday we disclosed our financials for last year, and we are in really good financial position as a university. People should be proud of that. And this goes well beyond just what we're doing in our student success rate, what we're doing with our academic programs, and what we're doing with our national ranking and what we're doing in sports. This is a time where institutions are freezing hiring. They are no longer taking certain PhD students because they're worried about the federal grants they can't get for their postdocs. They are worried about any promotions from within their universities. And we are not in that space. So as I look at the landscape of where we are compared to any of our peers, I see us in a unique space. And I'm proud of the work that we've done.
On Face the Nation, you made a distinction between the Ivy Leagues and the Ohio States of the world. Do you feel like, President Trump is, for lack of a better phrase, I guess he's picking on all of the Ivy League universities and he's going to leave you guys alone?
You know, I say this all the time. I said it on Face the Nation. I'll certainly say it to you. If we do the right things for the right reasons, we'll be able to make the argument why we do what we do. So, you know, it was pointed out that we're on a list for the Office of Civil Rights. Mm-hmm. I've said this all along. We're happy to talk to anybody to explain what we did and why we did it. We were on that list from the Biden administration. I feel very confident that we're doing the right things for the right reasons. And we're going to continue to, focus on the mission.
Has anyone from the Trump administration approached you about that list to talk about it? Or I don't know if investigated is the right word.
No,
has anything happened with the list?
We've only had some initial conversations, and we'll be willing to have more conversations when they're ready and if they want to. But you point out, a comment that I made, and I think it's an important one. As we're looking at this pivot for higher education, I said this and I firmly believe it, that the future of higher education is going to go through the large public land-grant flagship institutions like The Ohio State University. Not that the Ivies won't still have prestige. A lot of people are going to still want to go there. I'm not worried about their enrollment. They're having to fight a unique fight as a private institution. There have been some public institutions that also have come under fire too, though. So it isn't just the Ivies.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about changes to higher education with Ohio State University President Ted Carter. You mentioned that last year, faculty-led research grants brought in over $770 million to Ohio State. In June, we had two Ohio State professors come on our Tech Tuesday show. They were talking about deep cuts to the National Science Foundation and the National Institute for Health and how it's impacting their work. Here is Chris Orban. He is a member of Stand Up for Science, Ohio State, and he's talking about a directive he got from the university.
Well, one of the craziest things that happened in the last couple of months is that at one point, Ohio State told professors to stop applying for certain federal grants. Mm. So as it talks about in the press release, on May 2nd, an email went out to many professors saying that because of the changes to overhead, so a reduction of fourfold of the overhead that the federal government can pay, for now, just don't apply for federal grants. Never in my entire career have I been told to stop working towards federal grants as a professor.
Has that guidance to professors changed since then?
I don't know the details of what happened in that case, but I can tell you that we are applying for federal grants full on. I mean, like I said, we're flooding the zone, and I feel confident. In fact, our research grants from this time right now to where we were a year ago is up. Now, you mentioned the reductions at the federal government, the NIH, National Institute of Health, the National Science Foundation. What's interesting is there are other places that are growing. So our research arm in the Department of Defense has grown more than double just over the last 3 years, three times over the last 5 years. So for the first time in our history, our Department of Defense research portfolio is now bigger than our National Science Foundation portfolio. Now, that doesn't mean that we're still not going for Science Foundation grants or NIH grants. Those are big parts of our portfolio. As you pointed out at the beginning, $775 million last year out of our $1.6 billion portfolio. So it's about half. Mm-hmm. If the federal government reduces what's available by some percent, it doesn't mean necessarily that it's reduced by us by that much. It's just that we're going to have to work harder for those grants. And yes, in some of the cases, what's available out there has seen some changes. The professor mentioned something about indirect cost rates or overhead rates. The federal government imposed a 15% indirect cost rate limitation. That's a significant reduction from what had historically at some universities been 60 or 70%. Mm-hmm. We here at Ohio State were only at 40%. So we've been a little bit less impacted. But here's the good news. The federal government is reviewing that right now, and we have a seat at the table to help change what that formula is going to be. So things are going to get better. I'm very confident in that.
I wanted to move on to artificial intelligence because that's playing a big role in this coming school year. MIT released a first-of-its-kind study showing concerning findings about how AI impacts the brain and brain activity. The study found that those who use ChatGPT to write their essays show less brain activity. Are you familiar with this study?
I am.
So Ohio State is rolling out this requirement this year that all freshmen have to take an AI fluency course. Some professors are skeptical of it. But does the MIT study give you pause in the forward thinking of AI?
Well, the MIT study is just looking at one aspect of artificial intelligence, and that's just the ChatGPT. Artificial intelligence is so much more, so much bigger. We are the first institution in the United States that's taking a comprehensive approach to AI fluency. And the idea is very simple, that we want every student that graduates here with this incoming freshman class, so by the class of 2029 graduation, every student, regardless of their academic discipline, will be ready to go into the workforce and apply, not count on or not have to lean on ChatGPT, but apply artificial intelligence in their field of study. Nobody else is doing this because here's what this means. This means that we're going to engage our faculty, give them the tools so they understand artificial intelligence to include generative AI. That also means that we're going to apply this to our staff. So this goes across the entire enterprise of Ohio State. And then on top of that, we're going to create courseware for small businesses out here in Columbus and the state of Ohio that can, for a very low price, get some of this academic programming for their businesses. So that's part of our land grant mission, of course. We're very excited about this. Now, yes, I know there's going to be some skeptics that think that we're just going to dumb down students. That's not what the intent here is. We want to make sure that our students, when they go out into the workforce, that they're ready on day one, where 95% of all businesses in this country are saying they are going to be applying artificial intelligence. If you show up and you've never had access or exposure to these tools, now you have to be taught and now you're not ready. So this is to make sure that our students, when they graduate, they are going to be ready and competitive, and they are going to be the most valuable, you know, citizens that are going to be hired by businesses.
And do you feel that the university is going to have to change some maybe like academic requirements? If a professor thinks that they catch their student writing everything entirely with AI, I'm sure there's some academic discipline issues there. But you're now teaching them and telling them you want them to lean into AI. So have you talked about where the line is?
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of work to be done here. I mean, some professors will want students to have access to all the tools, which means that they're telling them to use it and see how that applies to the product that they produce. Some will say, hey, you know, you're going to take this test and you're not allowed to use it. So and a lot of our faculty have resources to be able to detect whether or not ChatGPT is being used. So, yes, there's certainly some work to be done here. And, you know, I'm just really excited. This isn't going to get done overnight. So this is going to take a little bit of time, but we're already underway. By the way, we've had 300 faculty members who are world-class AI experts working on this since 2018. So this isn't new. It's just that the initiative and this these outcomes. And by the way, there's a research arm to this. I'm just very excited. Again, as I talked about earlier, our financial standing right now allows us to play offense and put some of these initiatives together because, as you can imagine, not all this is being done for free. We're going to hire an additional 100 faculty who are going to be AI experts just in the course of the next year to start helping with this program. So we're really excited about it. This is a national level initiative.
Wow, 100 new faculty.
Yes.
That's a lot. Where are they going to go?
Well, some of them are going to be in the research AI hub. Some of them are going to be helping our faculty. So again, you just don't snap your fingers and this gets done. So there's some work to be done here.
Did you, when you announced rolling out this AI course for the incoming freshmen, did you also have an AI, do you have an AI course for professors, current professors who may be needed?
It's underway. It's being developed right now. You know, I travel all over the country. I get to see different alumni groups. And every time I talk about this, there's a generation of people that are not just in the tech industry, but young people. They are so excited about this. So it just tells me that we're going after the right thing.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about higher education with Ohio State University President Ted Carter. Coming up, we're going to be talking with President Carter about his new book. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We're talking this hour with Ohio State University President Ted Carter. A new school year is upon us. Colleges and universities across Ohio are navigating a new sweeping higher education law. And there's ever-changing rules at the federal level as well. That's why there's always a lot to talk about when we have our guest today stopping by. We're talking with Ohio State University President Ted Carter. Thanks for being with us again, President Carter.
Good to be with you, Amy.
Before we get to your book, I wanted to ask you something personal to us here. We here at WOSU, we're Ohio State employees. The university holds our license, but has no involvement in our radio or television programming content. We have an editorial firewall, so to speak. But as you're aware, the Trump administration defended the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which was the pass-through agency for NPR and PBS funding. So WOSU itself lost $2 million in federal funding. What role, if any, is the university taking in WOSU Public Media's work to account for this financial shortfall?
So not here to make any announcements today, but, you know, WOSU and what they do, the service they do for our university, the streaming services, the news that they produce, incredibly valuable to everybody, to Ohioans, particularly your reach in the rural communities. We are aware of what's going on. We're taking a very hard look at it, and we will continue to value the work that's done here. So we're looking at all the details, the finances, and we're just proud of what WSU has done over the years. So we're going to continue to be good partners.
Okay. Well, you're sitting here. You're my boss's boss's boss,
yeah,
right?
Right.
So I, you know, am I supposed to say, do you have a spare $2 million?
Yes. Not right on me, but again, I'll just say we know how valued this institution is, WOSU, and what they do. And we'll do what we can. We'll do what we're going to have to do.
So in your spare time, I don't think you have very much of it, you co-wrote a book with Jack Stark. It's a performance. He's a performance psychologist and psychotherapist who once was the team psychologist for the Nebraska football team. And you served as president of Nebraska University before coming to Ohio State. So the book is titled Top Gun Performance from the Cockpit to the Boardroom. And the title borrows from your experience in the U.S. Navy as both a participant and as an instructor. So it's less of a memoir and more of like a how-to on leadership and improving performance. Why did you want to write this book?
Well, this is my first foray into writing, and it was great to partner with Jack. Jack's written quite a few books. I think he's written 7+. So he brought the idea to me, to be quite frank. And, you know, what we found is we talked about the parallel between what it means to be at the top level of performance, whether it be in the classroom, whether it be in business or in sports, and then some of the principles of what Top Gun was built upon, you know, really, to be the best of the best, and also the teaching part of what Top Gun is all about. We found there's some really interesting parallels. So that's where the connection is between the two. Top Gun changed my life. I mean, I was there when the first movie was being filmed in 1985. It set my career on a path that allowed me to be an instructor for life. And in even my transition into higher ed, I found there to be an interesting parallel to that as well. So this is a bit of a self-help book with a couple of sea stories involved. And I think people that will pick it up will find some really useful information. There's some downloadable pieces on there that you can listen on audio. And you're right, it is something of a self-help or self-improvement type book. And the last thing I'll point out is it's a not-for-profit book. So I did write the vast majority of this while I was at Nebraska with Jack. It takes so long, as you know, to edit. So it just came out on August 1st. And all the proceeds from this book will go back to higher education, specifically Potomac Books, who is the publisher of this. So I feel good about that. Who knows? There may be another book in the future.
Oh, is that a little teaser there?
Yeah, just a little teaser. But, you know, what I learned is how hard it is. And you're right, I don't have a lot of free time. But I did enjoy this, and I do enjoy interacting with the public. And it's starting to get some momentum. A lot of people are interested in the book. And I see you have your copy with you.
Yeah, I do. There's a significant portion of the book that talks about the importance of sleep. And yeah. I have to think in your job, you don't get much sleep. But do you follow your own advice?
I do. In fact, I learned at sea, particularly flying in combat, that sleep is a weapon system. And I used to talk to my air crews about that. You can't perform well without sleep. And yes, there's some days and some weeks where I'll go with 5 or 6 hours, but I try very, very hard to get a minimum of 7. I try to work out regularly. It's what keeps your brain sharp and keeps your body in good shape. And, you know, as I like to say, being a university president these days is a contact sport, and you got to be in good shape to do it.
All right. So the book is Top Gun Performance, From the Cockpit to the Boardroom, and it's by Ted Carter and Jack Stark. There's no easy transition from that into the next topic, but this summer, the documentary Surviving Ohio State was released by HBO. It detailed the sexual abuse of many Ohio State athletes and students that they endured under Dr. Richard Strauss, who served as the team doctor for the wrestling team and other teams. He also worked at the Student Health Center. Now, while you weren't at the university when all this abuse occurred or even when it was reported, but the documentary is a damning portrait of a university that either looked the other way when it was happening or did nothing when it received complaints. Have you seen the documentary?
No, I have not. But I will say, you know, just up front, and I said this from the day I was first announced as a president, the university apologized to all those who were affected by that abuse. There's still a lot of legal work going on and mediation happening, so I don't want to comment much further than that, but I am aware of the documentary that's out there.
Were Ohio State officials, or you specifically, were you asked to be in the documentary?
No.
Okay. Would you have talked to them if they would have asked you?
I don't know that I would have much to say other than what I just said to you, because it happened so far ahead of my time.
So I should say the Ohio State officials were asked to be in the documentary but declined to comment. Do you know of any precautions or safety measures that are in place now so that we can make sure something like this doesn't happen again when it comes to reporting?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, some of this comes down to culture. And I talk about this with my leadership team all the way down to, you know, students. If something doesn't look right to you, it probably doesn't look right to me. So say something. I would say just knowing what I do know about that era. And by the way, this was a problem at many other universities. For some reason, that era, we here at Ohio State are not in the same place as what happened back then. I can say that with every confidence that we wouldn't tolerate that type of behavior. There's just no place for that. It's horrendous.
And are you up to date on where things stand with, civil lawsuits and other things like that?
I am. I just know that they're in a mediation process right now. That's what's known in the public right now as well.
Okay. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Ohio State University President Ted Carter. I wanted to shift gears here before we run out of time to talk about college sports, because that's on a lot of people's minds. And for the first time ever, Ohio State will be paying its athletes. Football, men's and women's basketball, and volleyball players will receive payments from a $20.5 million pool. What do you think about paying student athletes?
Well, it really doesn't matter what I think. It's where we are. And we are well poised to be able to do this. And we're going to do this in the fairest way possible and still be competitive. But, you know, at the end of the day, and I like to point this out, our student athletes are still students first. And they come to Ohio State not just because they think there's going to be some shared revenue, because they're going to get a degree. And we're really proud of that. You know, we won a national championship in football last year, but a lot of people may not be aware that our football team had the highest academic progress rate of any football team in the country. Now, the year before, there were two teams that had perfect scores. It was Harvard and The Ohio State University for football. This year, we're the only school that has a perfect score for academic progress rate. So, you know, that's a point of pride for us. But yes, we are in a different era with the House versus NCAA settlement case. We will be going through shared revenue. There's still a lot more rules to be written on name, image, and likeness. As your listeners may be aware, it's been in the news. I've just been appointed as a seat in the Board of Governors for the NCAA. So I'll be representing not only Ohio State, but the Big Ten at the highest level of governance for the NCAA. So I'm very proud that we will have a voice in what happens in the future.
Do you think these student athletes should be employees? I know they're going to be paid more like contractors.
I am personally, there's going to be some rules written on this. There's some federal legislation called the SCORE Act that's got some bipartisan support. I like mostly what I see in that, and that will protect students not as employees. And I think student athletes do better not as employees. They get more benefits from that. If student athletes become employees, I fear that the very student-athlete portion of this thing will start to be lost. So that's why I'm not in support of making them employees.
Especially with football. I mean, you know, the sports I mentioned, but football especially, it feels kind of like we have a professional sports program that happens to be housed at a university. How do you still make it feel like a student program?
Well, I've spent some time with a lot of our athletes, and not just the football program. And I will just tell you, they're proud to be students on campus. They love engaging. I mean, I spent a lot of time with our football team going through the championship run last year. I mean, these are just great young people. And they're proud of, you know, the degrees that they've earned. Many of them stay here, get master's degrees. So, yeah, they're here to learn and be prepared. Some of them go into the pros. You know, we put 14 of our football players in the NFL last year. That's a big number. But remember, we're graduating huge numbers, you know, north of 30 seniors plus. A lot of them are not going to go to the pros. So they're prepared to go into life, and the education we give them is going to set them up.
How do you make the other sports besides, I named football, men's and women's basketball, and volleyball, they're a part of this revenue sharing, which is a fancy way of saying paying them. How do you make the other sports still feel important?
Well, one of the things we did that's very different from other universities is we added scholarships. You know, when I got here, we had 1,100 student athletes. That's a big number, the biggest in the country. 36 Division I sports, also the largest program in the country. With these new rules, they put some roster limits on some of these sports. So our total number of student athletes by roster limits is going to get down to somewhere around 950. But the percent of those that are on full scholarship previously was only about 1 in 3 of our student athletes. We are now increasing that number because we provided more scholarship money to some of those sports that are not necessarily tied to the NIL, and we're taking that money off the NIL right from the top. So we are taking care of our Olympic sports and particularly our female Olympic sports. So we feel good that we're trying to find that right balance across all 36 sports.
We do have just about 2 or 3 minutes left, so I can pivot back to one other thing I wanted to ask you about, and it's the high rent around campus. You know, not everyone lives on campus. You don't even have room for everyone to live on campus. So the Dispatch recently did a story about these luxury units that are going out around Ohio State, highlighting the Rambler in particular, the newest complex. Rents there are $2,100 a month. That stunned me. I mean, it's not student housing, but does that stun you that something right across the street from Ohio State is so expensive?
Well, supply and demand, right? And if it's luxury and it's really nice, there's going to be some students that that can't afford to do that. And of course, it's voluntary. We're not forcing anybody to go live there or pay that rent. But I will say this about Dr. Melissa Shivers, who runs our Student Life Program. They do an amazing job of finding the right housing for the right budget for all of our students. The fact that we're going to move 15,000 plus students on campus over the course of 3 days across six different campuses, the majority obviously here on the Columbus campus, is an incredible amount of work. And they do it as well or better than anybody in the country. They go out there and they work with these different apartment complexes to do everything they can to keep those costs down and reasonable. Some we can help with. I mean, there's just going to be a variance in there.
In the minute we have left, there's a lot. Some students move off campus because some of the dorms are old, don't have air conditioning. What are you doing to make all that money that they do pay for a room and board to make the housing that you have to offer a little more hospitable?
We do everything we can. And again, I was there last year when our students moved in. I'll be there this year. You know, what I find is our students are really happy. Yes, we still have a small number of rooms that don't have air conditioning. I wish that wasn't the case. We're looking at long-term how we can make that quality of life on our campus the very best it can be. And all I can say is we're committed to making even more improvements as we go forward. Now, of course, we'll be a smaller freshman class coming in this year, so we'll be a little bit less dense on campus than we were last year, even with the vast majority of last year's freshman class coming in. And I think that will help a little bit.
We've been talking this hour with Ohio State University President Ted Carter. Thank you for your time today.
Amy, good to be with you. It was a good discussion.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us.